The previous program was Economic Update with Richard Wolf, heard right after the WBAI evening news on Wednesdays at 6:30 p.m. Stay tuned for Off the Hook. Coming up, it is now 7 p.m. Stay tuned.
And you're listening to radio station WBAI New York. The time is 7 o'clock. Time once again for Off the Hook. Everybody, the program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this delightful Wednesday evening, joined tonight by Kyle.
Yes, I read you.
Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
Gila.
Greetings and salutations.
And Alex.
Good evening.
And we're all back in the studio. No, we're not back in the studio, but it sounded like we were, didn't it? Sounded like we almost were back in the studio. I'll tell you, that day's going to come. It's going to come. It's happening. One day, soon. And, well, maybe not soon, but it's going to happen. Right? Tell me it's going to happen. Please, somebody tell me.
It's going to happen. We don't know when. We don't know how, but it is going to happen.
I don't know if I remember how to even get there. I really don't. And I certainly won't know how to work the board when I get there. It's going to be a comedy of errors. But, you know, we're all going through this. Alex, you're talking, but you're muted. So... You got to press.
No, I'm not.
Well, your mouth was moving and nothing was coming out. Is that normal?
I was cutting myself off because you were talking.
Okay, go ahead.
But I don't see why we can't go back to the station pretty damn soon. I mean, we're all vaccinated.
Well, we're not all totally vaccinated yet. We're getting there. I'm past my point where I'm considered completely vaccinated.
Maybe June we'll be able to talk about this in more detail.
Maybe,
serious.
But again, right now the station has armed guards preventing us from getting inside, so we can't even do that if we wanted to.
I think that's separate, isn't it? Or...
That might be. Yeah, it's only on Wednesday nights that I've noticed that.
It's weird.
Yeah. But whatever. The point is, we're able to use technology to bring the show to you. Can you imagine, though, if this whole pandemic had happened, say, 20 years ago, or maybe 30 or 40 years ago, you know, the 1960s, 1970s, how would we have survived as a society? We wouldn't have had remote learning. We wouldn't have had remote studios, not for people like us, anyway. Gila?
Not for people like us, but I do remember seeing something about... During the polio epidemic, there were classes being taught over the radio. Kids couldn't go to school, but they were learning remotely, even before screens in the way that we have them now.
I would love to know more about that. In fact, I'm sure there are recordings, what particular radio stations were involved in that. In fact, you know, now that you mention it, I have a bit of radio history that we're going to get to a little bit later in the program that fell into our laps. Well, we'll talk about how that happened a little bit later on, but... radio history is the most amazing thing, particularly here in New York City and the surrounding areas. So many stations, and ahead of them all, WBAI with our stories over the years, and some of them over the last 5 years. Alex, looks like you have something to say this time.
No, I didn't. Oh,
okay.
I didn't have anything to say.
Okay. Well,
sitting here listening, yeah.
Okay. We have some interesting news in the world of hacking. Guess who has been hacking into our computers lately?
I'm going to guess it's perhaps a federal agency that begins with F and ends with BI.
You know, I've told you, Alex, not to read the news stories before you get on the air, because when you do, you have all the answers, and that just makes you into a smart aleck, and nobody likes a smart aleck. Yes, you're right. The FBI has been hacking into our computers. How do you like that? All the stories I've seen on this have been rather vague as to what specific computers we're talking about, and I'm looking at a story from The Guardian. And they say the FBI has been hacking into the computers of U.S. companies running insecure versions of Microsoft software. Okay, first of all, it's kind of a redundant sentence, right? If you're running Microsoft software, you can assume it's insecure. But regardless, I'll let that go. But the operation, approved by a federal court, involved the FBI hacking into, and this is an odd number, hundreds of vulnerable computers. Seems like the number would be much higher than that. And that's to remove malware placed there by an earlier malicious hacking campaign, which Microsoft blamed on a Chinese hacking group known as Hafnium. Now, Hafnium's operation placed backdoors into tens of thousands of servers. Now, that's a number that's more realistic, running Microsoft's Exchange software, which allows businesses to manage emails, contacts, and calendars for their employees. It took advantage of a weakness in the servers, which has now been fixed, to plant the malware, which allowed the hackers to return at a later date. The FBI's campaign uses the same weakness in the hundreds of servers that have still not been patched to hack the hackers, breaking into the vulnerable computers and removing the backdoors entirely. But, you know, in order to find those hundreds that have not yet patched the security hole, that means the FBI has been trying tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of computers to see if it's been patched. And if it's not patched, they simply break in and fix it for you. What do you guys think of that?
I know a bunch of InfoSec types who are angry that the feds are now taking their jobs.
Uh-huh.
But, The implications of the story, though, in the public mind are a bit interesting, because I've seen more than one InfoSec person lament now that people, like laypersons out there, are now going to think they do not need to take care of their own security as much as they should, because they're like, well, the FBI is handling that now. I'll be safe.
Literally, Big Brother will come and fix it for you. Well, you know, I just remember back in the early days when we were basically, every other day it seemed, trying to legitimize the very existence of hackers, and saying that a lot of what hackers do is a public service because they're pointing out security flaws. And the hostility and the contempt with which that argument was met, saying, I did not tell you or invite you to access my computer. It's the same thing as going into my house, and I will shoot you through the computer somehow if you do it again. People were not pleased that this public service was going on without their permission. And I just wonder, did the FBI take this into account? Because there were some of the people saying that to us at the very beginning, that you didn't have permission to go and try and make things better. And now here they are doing that very thing. Yes, Alex?
This is such an interesting issue, actually. And I knew about this because I researched this quite extensively last night. I was quoted in an article by Jeremy Kirk today on Bank Info Security about this particular issue. And what's really fascinating here, too, is I don't know if you remember back in 2016, there was some hubbub about rule changes to the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, and in particular something known as Rule 41. That allowed a judge essentially to issue a search warrant that would allow the FBI or law enforcement to access computers or places that were outside of its judicial district. I remember specifically talking about this 5 years ago on the show. And, you know, the community was up in arms about this, you know, but the problem that this Rule 41 change was trying to address was that the legal system allows judges to have authority within their own judicial district. But if you're dealing with issues like terrorism or child pornography, you know, the usual subjects on which we generally cash in our civil liberties, it becomes very difficult for a judge to determine whether, you know, action is taking place within its own judicial district. And so issuing a search warrant could become almost impossible, especially if a threat actor or criminal or child pornographer is taking advantage of something like the Tor network, where your activity is routed through multiple hops, and it becomes very difficult to determine where you are physically in the world. So these Rule 41 changes are really intended to help the government battle things like online terrorism, pornography, and also to be able to take down botnets, because those are things that exist outside of the normal parameters of a physical judicial district. But this case, I think a lot of people were saying that this was the first time that Rule 41 was used to allow the FBI to do something like this, to actually make modifications on servers. I don't think it necessarily is. I think Rule 41 has been used in the past to take down botnets. But, you know, all that being said, there's a lot of very serious issues that arise from the FBI doing exactly what it did. I mean, from a cybersecurity perspective, the FBI has introduced change into the environments of many premises and their exchange servers. I mean, minor as it may be, it's still a federal government law enforcement agency. And this is what I had said to Jeremy Kirk, the reporter. You know, this is still a federal government law enforcement agency paternalistically. And by paternalism, I mean that that's the word that means they know better than you. They're telling you what you should be doing. It comes from the Latin word pater, for father, right? They're acting like our parents. But so they're accessing our private servers and altering our private data without, and here's a critical point, without notice to the data owners or the controllers. That's what's really crazy.
Now,
you know, this is Go ahead.
Well, the FBI says they're attempting to notify all the owners of the affected computers by either sending them an email from an official FBI email account or emailing their internet service providers. And I find it interesting they say they're attempting to do that, which means they haven't done it with everybody yet, and or maybe they never will.
Well, it's a little too late, and from my perspective, because you know, you've already had the government accessing your server. Right, they've caused some kind of change. They've caused data that was there at one point to not be there now, and that's a big problem, right? And so this all of this post hoc notification, the things are already done, right? Now here's another interesting possibility that I had dreamt up last night, which is there is a chance that those very web shells that the FBI received judicial authorization to remove may have remained on these exchange servers deliberately. They might have been honeypots, so that an organization could potentially identify what threat actors were after, what data these threat actors were actually seeking, and perhaps maybe even gather some information and some data about who these threat actors are, about who the Hafnium group is, or because these exchange vulnerabilities were so prevalent and being exploited so widely, this could have been any number of states, threat actors, criminal groups, etc., that were after an organization. So if the FBI caused those web shells to be deleted, web shells that were left there deliberately as a honeypot, they may have compromised intelligence gathering procedures.
Absolutely.
And who would be liable for that? Is the FBI going to pick up the tab if they screwed up an intelligence-gathering operation on which an organization may have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars?
Now, it should be pointed out that they didn't fix the vulnerability. They simply removed the malware that supposedly had been placed by this hacker group from China. But, you know, I find it really interesting because you remember the house analogy, the dreaded house analogy we had to deal with back in the 80s and 90s. That's where somebody would try to compare computer intrusion with intruding into someone's house. I always found issue with that because, first of all, logging into a massive computer system is not the same thing as entering somebody's house. People would try and say this, I feel violated, all the same. There are so many ways it's different, but I'd like to use that analogy now. I'd always be on the other side of that analogy and say, well, what if you had a lock on your front door that wasn't the best lock there was, and that actually there were some vulnerabilities, and people could potentially get into your house? How would you feel if you woke up one day and there was a new lock on your door that you didn't ask for, and that somebody had just put there because they knew better than you? I mean, yeah, it's kind of a nice thing to do, but it's also kind of disturbing to have somebody just sort of oversee you like that.
Yeah, no doubt. You know, and I think, you know, you raise, I think, also another very important point here, that they didn't patch the other vulnerabilities on the server. They only removed the web shells that were placed there that would facilitate the remote access that these threat actors had to these particular servers. So in that context, it should be obvious that this is a very drastic government action to remove a vulnerability, but it can't be stressed enough that these drastic actions didn't actually solve the problem. They weren't a panacea. I mean, the Department of Justice itself, in its press release about this operation, conceded that the threat actors may have placed additional malware, perhaps things like rootkits or other remote access tools to facilitate continued access to these servers on the victim exchange servers themselves. And it also, you know, it needs to be said that removing the web shells doesn't mean that the web shells can't be replaced there. So, you know, they left the vulnerabilities in place, removed the web shells. And another, I think, crazy issue that arises from this is that there's also an inherent danger in executing the code of threat actors. The way in which the FBI removed these web shells was by using the actual code of the threat actors itself, by using the programs that they had designed. So it's entirely possible to dream up a situation where a sophisticated group of cyber adversaries or threat actors anticipate and in fact, maybe even encourage law enforcement like the FBI to utilize what appears to be some kind of built-in remote destruction capabilities, but they may actually be booby-trapped. They may actually be malicious code. So instead of perhaps removing this en masse like they thought was going to happen, it would be entirely possible to dream up a situation where instead of a removal procedure, perhaps the malicious code started encrypting data, started deploying ransomware. So, you know, I think you can call me old-fashioned, but I don't trust the code of foreign adversaries to do what it appears to be designed to do. And I think that's what the FBI did in this situation.
Only
that's
foreign scary. Adversaries or adversaries in general?
Just foreign adversaries. I trust my local domestic American adversaries, you know, very well.
Oh, you poor fool.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I just wonder, if somebody were to place that code on their own site, would the FBI come knocking and remove it? And if so, would you be able to get information about their servers, their systems that were accessing your system? I'm just trying to figure out how many ways the system can be confused, their system can be confused, and what adversaries of any nation can learn from these do-gooders that are going out trying to erase what they believe to be malware.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question, too. I wonder about, you know, what traces they left on these servers, and then, you know, the other thing that arises from this, too, which is more personal and political, I think, than anything else. But yeah, what if you were one of these system administrators that had this done to your Exchange servers? I mean, there's going to be some issue of stigma that arises from this. I mean, plenty of CISOs or IT administrators who were running these on-premises Exchange servers that the FBI altered are going to be in a sort of awkward situation to have to explain why they didn't remove the web shells themselves. But also, there's any number of reasons why. I mean, for instance, sure, they could have been using it as a honeypot, or they may have been completely under-resourced. They might not have had the resources to pay attention to this, or it might have been a disused Exchange server that the FBI then accessed and altered, or perhaps they're under-resourced, and they are putting out 10 other fires that may relate to other exploits, you know, from the Hafnium group that were placed on their servers. So, you know, I don't think we can blame the victim here, but the FBI coming out proactively and doing the job of what IT administrators and CISOs would ordinarily be doing can place those very people in a strange situation where they may not be happy with the FBI, and in a time where what we hear from the federal government and all of our federal agencies is that we need more cooperation between the federal sector and the private sector. I'm not sure if this type of proactive, let me go get it for you activity from the FBI is going to encourage any of that collaboration going forward.
Yes, Rob.
I'm done.
Rob, do you have something?
No, I think that was very well put and well said. And also, I still don't trust the feds.
Okay, well, that's probably a good policy. But we're going to continue talking about the feds because there is more. Remember that story about 5 years ago, the San Bernardino shooting, where the FBI got into a standoff with Apple about unlocking an iPhone. Well, it turned out it was unlocked by a third party that up until fairly recently was kind of anonymous. But it turns out Asmus Security, a publicity-shy company that says it sells its cyberwares only to democratic governments, secretly crafted the solution the FBI used to gain access to the device, and that's according to several people familiar with the matter. The iPhone was used by one of the two shooters whose December 2015 attack left more than a dozen people dead. The identity of the hacking firm has remained a closely guarded secret for 5 years. Even Apple didn't know which vendor the FBI used, according to company spokesman Todd Wilder. But without realizing it, Apple's attorneys came close last year to learning of Asimov's role through a different court case, one that has nothing to do with unlocking a terrorist device. 5 years ago, Apple and the FBI both cast the struggle over the iPhone as a moral battle. The FBI believed Apple should help it obtain information to investigate the terrorist attack. Apple believed that creating a backdoor into the phone would weaken security and could be used by malicious actors. The FBI sought a court order to compel Apple to help the government. Weeks later, the FBI backed down after it found an outside group that had a solution to gain access to the phone. The tale of the unlocking of this iPhone, which was reconstructed through Washington Post interviews with several people close to the situation, shines a light on the hidden world of bug hunters and their often fraught relationship with the creators of the devices whose flaws they uncover. Now, Asimov is a poster child for white hat hacking, according to experts. That's good guy cybersecurity research that aims to disclose flaws and disavows authoritarian governments. Two Asimov hackers teamed up to break into the San Bernardino iPhone. That's according to people familiar with the matter, who, like others, spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss sensitive matters. Now, founder Mark Dowd is an Australian coder who runs marathons and who one colleague said can pretty much look at a computer and break into it. Yeah, I'd like to test that out. One of his researchers was David Wang, who first set hands on a keyboard at age 8, dropped out of Yale, and by 27 had a prestigious Pony Award, that's PWNIE, an Oscar for hackers for jailbreaking or removing the software restrictions of an iPhone. Many security researchers say it's legitimate to sell these flaws to democratic governments, and the ability of government agencies to unlock iPhones has also spared Apple from direct conflict with those governments. For instance, by unlocking the terrorist iPhone, some say Asimov came to Apple's rescue by ending a case that could have led to a court-ordered backdoor to the iPhone. I know we were all concerned about that 5 years ago. Now, turns out, when the FBI got the phone unlocked, there was nothing of real significance, no links to foreign terrorists, nothing like that was found. And the government subsequently abandoned its legal bid to force Apple to unlock the phone. Now, Apple then sought to recruit Wang to work on security research. I believe they didn't know that he was involved in this at that point. Instead, in 2017, he founded a company called Corellium, based in South Florida. Their tools help security researchers run tests on Apple's mobile operating system using virtual iPhones, and those virtual phones run on a server and display on a desktop computer. And in 2019, get this, Apple sued Corellium for copyright violation, As part of the lawsuit, Apple pressed Corellium and Wang to divulge information about hacking techniques that may have aided governments and agencies such as the FBI. In its lawsuit, Apple argued that Corellium has no plausible defense for infringing on Apple's copyright, in part because it indiscriminately markets its iPhone replicas to any customer, including foreign governments and commercial enterprises. Corellium has denied that allegations. It's countered that the lawsuit is an attempt to put it out of business following a failed attempt by Apple to purchase the company in 2018. Yeah, a month or two after the FBI unlocked the iPhone, the San Bernardino iPhone, Mozilla discovered the flaw in the software and patched it in a routine update. So did vendors that relied on the software, including Apple, and the exploit has since been rendered useless. I don't know. You know, I see a lot in this story that these independent companies, they really can serve the purpose that it would be very dangerous for a company like Apple or Google for them to be expected to do this, to unlock their phones. If some hacker someplace can figure out how to get in, doesn't that solve the problem of having a company have a backdoor or have to be required to have a backdoor? I really think Apple should be grateful to the person that they're trying to sue, because imagine if they had not come along, this would have wound up in court. We could very well be in a society now where backdoors were considered mandatory. Alex, what are your legal thoughts on that?
Well, I think this is the Corellium case is actually quite near and dear to me. And in fact, one of my colleagues from my old days at the law firm of Steptoe & Johnson, David Hecht, who is now with Hecht Partners, he was actually he is co-counsel for Corellium in its battle against Apple. And I believe that a couple of months ago, right at the end of 2020, there was a ruling from the federal district court that ruled in favor of Corellium, that found that what they were doing with respect to the virtualization of iPhones and iOS was fair use under copyright law, which I thought was great. And, I think I was actually quoted in a Washington Post article as well about this particular victory, because it is it's pretty significant for security researchers to be able to virtualize and test distinct components of this kind of third-party software for security vulnerabilities, because prior to this ruling, what was preventing them from doing this was potential legal liability. But from an encryption perspective, I don't know if it necessarily solves the problem to have a third party in the possession of a vulnerability that could be used to unlock an iPhone. I don't think it entirely solves the problem. And we know it doesn't entirely solve the problem, because the Department of Justice is still going after what they call lawful access requirements, or what we would otherwise call an encryption backdoor, or some kind of backdoor security feature that would allow the government to have access based on some kind of judicial authorization to an iPhone or an otherwise encrypted device or communication. So, you know, the governments are still going after this. Security researchers are still pushing back. Everyone on our side that's following the data, following the science, knows that, you know, any kind of encryption backdoor would be a terrible, terrible idea. But one other issue that arises to me in the context of having third parties in the possession of these really critical vulnerabilities is that some of these companies may be unscrupulous, and they may sell them to countries that don't have the greatest record of respect for human rights, let's say, right? They may use them to access iPhone data or any kind of data to identify whether people are part of a certain class, or part of a certain religion, you know, maybe homosexuals, you know, or some other characteristic that would allow a government to target minority populations. And so I think it's very tricky to say that somebody should have a repository of this type of security information or security vulnerabilities without it being really dangerous. I mean, I believe in in disclosing this type of data to Apple so that they can patch it and we can all believe in the security of our products and all have some greater level of faith in it. I think sharing is caring when it comes to this kind of data.
Yes, Gila.
I'm sorry. I had an itch.
Oh, you were raising a hand. Okay. Rob, go ahead.
There's also the other end of this where we live in a world where you can do things if you're adept enough or if you get an adept community together to put together things like alternative operating systems, free operating systems that are open source that the code is shared all over the world for completely free. And what would happen if we had an ecosystem of required backdoors? You can't tell a community, an international community of coders, that they have to put in a backdoor. And if you do, that backdoor will be open source and everyone will know the vulnerability. So it is not a practical thing to require of people making all operating systems. But if the commercial operating systems did it, then, you know, where's the level playing field that everyone loves so much? Because everyone concerned with security could just go to an alternative one. There's also the fact that just if you lock the front door of your house, but the back door is required to be left unlocked with a sign on it saying authority figures only, that is not good security practice.
Well said, yes. Okay, you know, I want to get to the promised part of the program now where we look at a bit of radio history. And for this, we need to know a couple of things as far as how networks of radio stations, particular radio stations, would communicate with each other. In this particular case, we're going to be looking at CBS, the network CBS. Now, we've mentioned that we're working on a whole bunch of audio to release this year, old shows and interviews and things like that. We have a massive library, and some of the things that we found have absolutely nothing to do with us at Off the Hook or 2600 or even any of us personally. This is one of those items. This has to do with a network that a communications network that CBS used to run. It used to be called the Radio Stations News Service, RSNS. But before that, it was known as PLNX, which basically is Private Line News Exchange. This was a communications network that people in news departments at CBS-owned stations throughout the country, most of which were all news, would use to communicate with each other when there was a breaking story, or even when there wasn't a breaking story, just to coordinate programming. Okay, so we know something about CBS. This is back in the 1970s, and we know about their communications network. The other thing we need to know about is someone named Bubbles the Hippo. Yeah, Bubbles the Hippo was a hippopotamus from Orange County, California. And she managed to burrow under her fence, squeeze past a barricade, and lumber away from her pen back in February of 1978. And this was at the old Lion Country Safari Animal Park in Irvine, California. She found a marshy drainage pit and settled in for a standoff with park rangers, rarely showing much more than her nostrils above the waterline. Crowds gathered, television cameras arrived, even Johnny Carson was having a laugh at the wayward hippo in Orange County. Well, Bubbles emerged from her watery hideout a few days into her escape and was greeted with a tranquilizer dart. She crumpled to the ground. Three rangers approached, and one tapped her with a wooden pole. Bubbles roused with a mighty snort, the Register reported, and promptly treed two rangers and sent the third scampering. Bubbles flicked her tail and rumbled back into the pond. For 19 days, Bubbles wallowed in her pond as news helicopters clattered overhead and highway patrol officers directed traffic on nearby roads. She refused to budge, even when rangers baited a huge net with her favorite food, which was alfalfa. And then, as night fell on her 19th day of freedom, Bubbles pulled herself out of the shallows and wandered up a nearby hill. A ranger approached her in the dark and shot her with two tranquilizer darts. She staggered for a few more steps before her knees gave out and she collapsed. A veterinarian arrived and gave her a dose of a potent calming drug. The cheering and backslapping of her capture soon turned to disbelief and then tears as the park rangers realized that Bubbles had stopped breathing. The official story from Lion Country Safari has always been that Bubbles fell in an awkward position on the hill, and her heavy internal organs pressed against her lungs, suffocating her. Well, what I'd like to play now is audio that somehow fell into our possession of CBS News employees communicating amongst themselves, coordinating what to put on the air in the wake of the story. Runs about 10 minutes. Enjoy. Okay, or don't enjoy as we figure out what's wrong with our equipment here. That should have worked. Let me try it again.
UPI, I think it's 0043, it's on Bubbles, it's Hippo.
Yeah.
Being recaptured. We just found out that Bubbles is dead.
We don't
have anyone available.
Bubbles is dead. What happened?
Apparently they tranquilized her and they don't know if it was a drug reaction or what.
Net alert. Oh, God.
Yeah, the cause is unknown. So,
that's a national emergency. I gotta kill all the sound I have now.
Right.
That's number nine coming right
up. Right.
Yeah. So, is this for sure that Bubbles is dead, though?
Bubbles is dead.
I'm going to cry. How did it happen?
Well, they tranquilized her, gave her tissue, they shot her twice, and they don't know the cause. They don't know if it was drug-related or what.
That's the TV headlines now. Hippo OD'd.
Right.
Film at 11.
Yeah, right. But, unfortunately, we don't have anyone available that can prepare anything for a while, so...
Must be all that bad weather you're having.
If you want a phone number, I can give you a phone number for the...
For Bubbles?
For the park.
When will you have somebody...
quite some time.
Who can do the hippo story.
That'll be a little...
Yeah, we want four raps and five actualities on it. I want sound effects. Hey.
If anybody wants to talk to a teary-eyed park spokeswoman, you can.
Oh.
They must have had one hell of a time trying to wheel her in on a stretcher.
Do you have any sound on it, L.A., or San Fran?
No, we don't.
I figure San Fran would want some sound.
Oh, yeah.
San Fran always wants sound.
Right. Well,
Who's in charge of the arrangements?
How can you joke at a time like this?
Wow, well, thanks for the bulletin, Los Angeles. Can we send donations anywhere? Let's set up a Bubbles fund. I think that's a good idea.
All right.
For, you know, wayward hippos. Bye-bye.
Boston.
New York. San Fran.
Toronto.
I know it's coming.
New York.
Right. Bubbles. It's the station's L.A. We're offering a voicer.
T.O.P. Washington.
The reporter is Tom Brown. We're offering a voicer on the death of Bubbles.
You know, the flags are flying at half staff in Philadelphia.
Half staff?
Where else but the city of brotherly love?
It's awful. It's awful.
Okay, stations, if you're ready.
Wait a minute. Oh. New York is not ready yet.
Stations, by the way, this is San Francisco, and we'll have some raw tape or some tape actuality later on with the spokesman from Lion Country. We're cutting it up right now, so we'll have it shortly.
Well, be a race between you and L.A., right?
Okay, New York is early.
1 second.
Hit it.
Stations LA offering a voicer. Reporter's Tom Brown. It's untimed. The feed from LA in 5. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Bubbles, the fugitive.
Don't try you.
Brown in Los Angeles.
If there are no questions, that concludes the feed from LA.
Can we have a repeat on that, please?
That was done live.
Oh, terrific. Hey, thank you, Tom Brown.
Do you need a repeat?
Yeah, this is San Fran. We're on a standard roll-up here, and we needed to roll off of it.
Yeah, hold on a second.
There's not a dry eye in the house here.
Okay. I'll get Tom here. Are you rolling, San Fran?
Right.
Okay. The feed in 5, 4, 3, two, one.
Bubbles, the fugitive hippopotamus who eluded captors, was dead. This is Tom Brown in Los Angeles.
Okay, got it. Thanks.
Okay, we just saw that hippo.
Yeah.
Thanks.
We'll feed that actuality to you in a little bit.
We can't take it. We're out of touch.
Yeah. Oh, terrific.
Right.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
See you, bye.
Bye. LA.
Yeah, this is New York on your hippo feed and so forth. I just listened to it. You fed it twice. And, man...
Maybe you said it in here. Someone cut it on me.
Yeah. As I say, the level on it is down so far, you can hardly hear it. And do you have any trouble feeding live into the planks or something? Because,
No, why don't you check with someone else,
listening to it, just comparing it with San Fran's voice. You know, you were talking with him. You're... 15 dB down.
I'm in a technician, and Edward's not here, so... Why don't you, if you want the feed, call one of the other stations and get it.
Well, all I'll get is what you fed out, which would be the same thing.
Oh, I can't.
Very noisy and low level.
Well, I can't give you anything else.
You can't do anything else for us?
No, the guy's on the air now.
Okay, Doug. Right. Sure. Bye-bye. Bye.
Philadelphia.
Hello.
LA.
Toronto.
San Francisco.
Yes, Washington.
Stations, this is the network headline for the hour. Secretary of State Vance to meet with President Carter today in the White House in preparation of Prime Minister Begin's visit.
You mean you're not meeting with Bubbles?
No, we're not meeting with Bubbles.
What kind of network is this?
Hey, come on. Show a little respect.
Is Bubbles going to anchor the broadcast?
What kind of network? We're switching to ABC. That's it.
Mutual just broke in with it.
Mutual, huh? Great.
Philadelphia.
Hi, Philly. T.O.P. Washington here. Can we get a forecast for you, like what's going to be like high today?
All right. To wake up our weatherman. He's still in mourning from Bubbles.
Yes, we're all mourning here, too. Got writers crying, engineers who...
Well, if you head north up 95 from Washington and you reach the Philadelphia area, what you'll... All right.
Okay, well, I got to go back to mourning Bubbles.
We'll talk to you later.
Bye.
Chicago.
New York.
T.O.P. Washington.
Boston.
Detroit.
Stations, this is network. The headline for the hour. Coal talks resume in Washington this morning.
What about Bubbles?
That's Steve Young's anchor.
Okay, thank you, Matt. T.O.P. Washington.
Detroit.
Stations is a network. Coal. Again, is the headline.
Oh, wow.
Negotiations resume this morning.
How long have you been doing this?
What, coal?
Yeah.
96 days.
Just say coal. That'll be fine.
Just say coal.
Toronto, Boston,
LA,
Bubblesville,
Detroit,
San Fran.
Stations, this is the network. The headline is Washington negotiations to end the coal strike scheduled to resume 1 hour from now, and the anchor is Young.
Chicago. Chicago. Toronto.
San Fran.
The network there, too?
Yeah, that was here.
Yeah, this is an advisory from Los Angeles. Preliminary results on a post-mortem on Bubbles, the hippo that died last night, indicate apparently that she was at least 5 months pregnant. For those of you who are following the Bubble story, we'll have an update on this within the hour, but I just wanted to get the information out to you before the rest of the wire's broken story.
I love it.
What's the gestation period for a hippopotamus?
I don't know. Haven't had a chance to look it up yet.
Okay.
But anyway, according to park officials, she appeared to be about 5 months pregnant.
Was it a boy or a girl?
We don't know.
Okay.
Anyway, we'll have further information for you within the hour on that story and some tape for you.
Thank you.
Advisory from L.A.
I'm sorry, dialed incorrectly.
Boston.
San
Fran. The T.O.P. St. Louis. Station's Los Angeles calling. We have a wrap and a wild track we'd like to offer you in connection with the death of Bubbles the Hippo.
All right.
The wrap is by reporter Diane Cummings. It runs 1 minute 8 seconds in length. The wild track running 42 seconds in length. The out cue that happened. The voice is that of Joe Schetter, S-C-H-E-T-T-E-R. She is spokeswoman for Lion Country Safari. We'll re-billboard and feed both pieces to you in 30 seconds.
Fortunate thing that happened.
Okay, stations, that concludes the feed from L.A.
Let's have a moment of silence.
Yes, indeed. Let's have a moment of silence for Bubbles the Hippo in a recording from 43 years ago, 1978. That was some internal communications that has somehow fell into our hands a bunch of years ago. It doesn't seem to be anywhere else. Fascinating look at a network known as Plinx. I heard somebody describe it as Plinx, P-L-N-X, Private Line News Exchange, that the CBS radio network used to communicate amongst their radio stations. What do you guys think of that? Riveting stuff, huh?
That was amazing.
I hope some CBS engineer or news staff from the past was able to hear that and just bring back a whole ton of memories. That's radio history. You don't get any more historical than that.
I mean, it told a really interesting story that just got sadder with every twist and turn as well.
Bubbles was pregnant. Bubbles was pregnant. My God, just
that obviously was the very sad twist at the end there. And for our listeners out there wondering what the gestation period of a hippopotamus is, it's 8 months.
You see, back then you couldn't just hop online and look it up like you undoubtedly just did.
Who says I looked it up? I mean, maybe I just knew that.
Maybe you knew that. That is entirely possible. I found the relationship between all the different stations to be fascinating. For some reason, Washington, D.C. always picked up with the call letters. They always said T.O.P. Washington, W.T.O.P., but everybody else would give the name of the city. And the ring was interesting, too. I'd like to know more about that particular communication system they used. This is the kind of thing that a group like Negative Land would love. Maybe they gave it to me. I don't know. I don't know where this came from. If anyone has a source, I couldn't find it anywhere online. So now it's out there.
Yeah, poor old Bubbles. I'm just like, she was the Harambe of her time, obviously, and my jimmies are well and truly rustled.
So I found two interesting things about this. The first is that Lion Country Safari donated Bubbles' body to the Los Angeles Natural History Museum.
Oh, boy.
She's not on display, though. She's in a warehouse. Her bones are in boxes in a warehouse. So, Alex, if you thought the pregnant part was a sad coda, she's, in boxes in a warehouse. Okay, so that's thing number one. But thing number two is it was reminding me almost of, a long time ago I used to have regular conference calls with colleagues from all over the country, and even now when you're on a Zoom with people on a regular basis, you're dropping in, you're dropping out, people are discussing it, and I was getting that sense of, the camaraderie that you can have on this kind of call was just so much fun, and the colleagues in the network and how that sense of working together, even when working apart. And I liked how they were teasing each other. It was great.
Yes. They all would know each other. I'm just thinking of the technology, how the technology was so different then. Like the actual landline was the thing that tied everybody together. And that's where you got your updates, and that's how the news was fed across. There was no internet. There was no way people could go out and access something online. They could buy a newspaper. They could watch television. They could listen to the radio. That was it. So it carried tremendous importance what those people were doing. It seemed a bit lighthearted at the time, but that develops in working relationships. Yes, Rob.
There's also that sense that, along with the easy camaraderie and stuff, it's interesting to see how they propagated like things like the recording of a news brief like that throughout their stations in the analog era. It amounted basically to, okay, everyone hit record. I'm going to play the thing, or in this case, just say it live. We have producers nowadays here at WBAI who have been uploading their show just as a digital audio file so the engineer back at the station can press play. And, you know, the ways we do things, in some ways it's very like how they did it back then. In some ways we're doing a lot better. It's interesting.
Absolutely. You're listening to Off the Hook here on WBAI. We're going to be going to overtime at 8 o'clock. You can reach that by going to 2600.com, looking at the link up on top of the page, or simply going to our YouTube channel. It's called Channel 2600. And we'll be able to take phone calls on that particular means of communication. The phone number is 802-321-HACK, 802-321-4225. But before we leave the traditional airwaves, I'd like to touch upon one other story, which is a little bit disturbing and kind of scary and also fascinating. It turns out Domino's Pizza and Nuro, which is a Silicon Valley startup, have announced they're going to be launching a robotic pizza delivery service in Houston. In fact, it might already be in service, if any of our Houston listeners could tell us about this. Small, low-speed vehicles be carrying packages instead of people, and this Nuro company has won U.S. clearance to start doing this kind of thing. They actually got the contract last year. Now, the delivery service will begin at a Domino's outlet in Houston before expanding to serve customers in many other locations as part of a long-term partnership. Nuro said Domino's had said in 2019 they expected to launch robot pizza delivery late that year, 2019. But they've taken a measured approach to prioritize a smooth and safe deployment. Now, Nuro was founded by two former Google engineers in 2016. So, I don't know. Soon we're going to be seeing robotic vehicles delivering pizzas on the street. I just wonder how that's going to go. Low-speed vehicles for now, and who knows how high-speed. I mean, Domino's, the whole thing is get it there in a half hour. So I don't think low-speed is something they're going to want to hang on to for very long.
I don't know. I'd be interested in if you see a pizza robot pass you on the sidewalk and what kind of measures can be taken. Maybe carry around an EMP for, free pizza. I don't know.
Well, of course, I like to find out ways of making mischief with these kinds of devices. What happens if a whole line of people stand in front of one of them? You get your pizza free. That's what happens. Technology is changing, always is, and we'll be here to follow it. OTH at 2600.com is our email address. Again, overtime begins at 8 o'clock on our YouTube channel. We will see you here on WBAI next week. Keep listening to 99.5 FM and donate. Donate as much as you can. 212-209-2950 or give to WBAI.org. See you next week.
Hannah from WBAI's premiums department. As you may know, WBAI now has a new phone number to call to make donations or to pledge for premiums at 212-209-2950. Thank you for being a WBAI member and for making a contribution to keep the station afloat. But if you have a question about a premium, please do not call that number. All the call center can do is take down the info and send it to premiums@wbai.org, and time on the line costs us money. Instead, please email us directly with your question or concern. The email is premiums@wbai.org or call 212-209-2870. We promise to get back to you within a week's time. Again, please call 212-209-2870 if you have a question about a premium you ordered, or email premiums@wbai.org.